favorite indie band is The Mountain Goes. It's Lucky Paper Radio. I'm your host, Andy, and I'm here with my co-host, Anthony, Broken Time Spiral Remastered Sealed Deck Maddox.
I can't really take credit for that, but sure.
You correctly identified that you should play all those broken cards. Your seal pool really came together quite nicely. You've got what? You've got Magus of the Future, Aeon Chronicler, Mystic Confluence, then that's kind of backed up by the bread and butter stuff like Solemn Simulacrum, Thraben Inspector, multiple ways to pick up your creatures and replay them. It's pretty gross. I don't think my pool can beat it.
That was really the fun part that I didn't expect to come together. You know, I'm looking at all these really synergistic cards. We got Slivers, we got Rebels, all these weird things going on in Time Spiral Remastered. And the Blink stuff seems like kind of a light theme, but it ended up turning out really well and being a ton of fun. What's that card that creates two soldiers when you cast it?
Great question. Pick up it's two like things? A 5-mana white card. It's yeah. 3/4 flyer or something like that. I don't know. Someone's going to have to find it.
Stormcaller, something or other.
Yeah, whatever. You did blow me out in that game where you curved Thraben Inspector into Solemn Simulacrum into that card to pick up both your Solemn Simulacrum and your Thraben Inspector. And then you played Magus of the Future, reveal Mystic Confluence on top. It was bad. It was a bad look for me. I don't think there's any draw of my deck that beats your deck playing lands and spells.
But, you know, that's kind of the great thing about Magic. Sometimes even a mediocre player can just win a game because they have broken cards in their pool.
You're not a mediocre player, though, Anthony. You're an excellent player. This conversation reminds me, though, I want to point people to Paolo Vito Domodorosa, which I mentioned his YouTube page on this show a while ago, but I want to re-up my recommendation for PV's new YouTube channel. New-ish. It's new as of, like, January now, so it's been going for a minute. He's been doing a video every week, and a couple weeks ago he did a video on the best players in Magic history, by his reckoning, and he made a careful point to talk about what he thinks each of those players is uniquely good at, which is a very interesting perspective into, I mean, obviously PV is one of the best of all time, knows these players very intimately for the most part. In that video, and then in a subsequent article he wrote, kind of expanding on that video, he talks about Shuhei Nakamura, who's obviously a fantastic player, but he specifically notes that Shuhei's greatest strength, by PV's reckoning, is playing with bad cards. Just one of the best players in the world at taking a bad sealed pool, a bad draft deck, something kind of gone off the rails, and salvaging it through cunning play. And of all of the skills of a highly skilled Magic player, that's the one I think I would want the most. I think that's kind of the most impressive skill to me, is being able to pull out wins with bad cards. Because I can't tell you how many times I just feel like my deck can't possibly win. And that can't be true very often. just by how Magic works. I think I feel that way more often than it's actually true.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. Like, that's the kind of spike that I am. I don't really... Constructed doesn't really appeal to me. Like, the idea of just knowing a meta and getting just the right deck and understanding exactly the kind of play patterns that deck is gonna be looking for doesn't even compare to the amount of excitement that I get from, like, here's a pile of weird cards that don't really fit together or kind of do in complicated ways, but you just have to figure that out, and it's gonna be a unique and novel deck build every single time. I mean, that's why we love Limited and Cube, but it's just the most fun way to play Magic.
I agree completely. And he describes Shuhei's patience, basically, as being the virtue that leads to this success. And every time I feel like I'm patient with my bad cards, I just fall further and further behind, and I was patient at the wrong time. And, you know,
not getting tilted and saying, well, my cards are bad, so I'm losing, but instead figuring out, well, how do I get every ounce of value, even when I'm behind?
It's the second one. It's how do you get every ounce of value out of the card? I think regardless of whether you're ahead or behind, just realizing that if your cards are worse, you're going to have to squeeze every drop of value out of them. He does specifically mention Ben Stark, obviously, as the player that is best at not getting tilted and just being a human robot. So yeah, it's a great article and a great YouTube channel. I've really appreciated basically every video that PV has put out. Yeah, even, like, there was one just talking about the best decks in Standard, which I play no Standard, very minimal interest in Constructed, but I still think it's beneficial to look at a pro player's breakdown of a Constructed meta and how those decks relate to each other. So,
yeah, I mean, it's also fun just to think about, you know, progression in getting better and improving at Magic is not linear. Like, there are a lot of different aspects of the game, and the reason that really gets me excited is just realizing that I can learn something from pretty much everybody who plays the game. Even if they're at a similar skill level to me, it doesn't mean we're in exactly the same place. Understanding what makes them a better player in certain areas is just going to let me get a lot more value, and is part of what makes the community awesome.
It's also great because I feel like it offers more of an avenue to, like, really maximizing the part of the game that comes naturally to you. If the only option it was this linear scale of everyone's either good at magic or bad at magic and somewhere on this spectrum,
yeah, then, if you're just, like, stuck on step three, if there's no way to progress, but there's lots of ways to progress.
Right. If you're just like, well, I'm never going to be the best magic player in my playgroup, then what does it matter? But you could become the best at a specific format or a specific type of gameplay. I would say, Anthony, my strength is I'm really good at winning when my deck is much better than my opponent's and draw poorly. This week on Lucky Paper Radio, we are talking about power level, and specifically the delta in power between cards in one's cube and how that affects the design of the environment. Anthony has told me that he has copious notes prepared for this episode, and it's going to be great. He's going to lead us on a great monologue, so we're all looking forward to Anthony's introduction to this topic. But before we get there, we are going to do a listener-submitted Pack 1, Pick 1 from a listener cube. Keen listeners to the show will recognize this. So we actually answered a question from this listener. You'll remember that listener Nate sent that voice memo in talking about the power level band of cards in his Peasant cube, how to decide what to quote-unquote ban from Peasant for his own environment. And as a result of the conversation we had, he ended up designing a pretty pushed Peasant environment that actually plays all of the cards in his voice memo that he said he was excluding for power level reasons. Things like Library of Alexandria, Sol Ring, Channel.
Not all uncommons are created equal. Cards like Channel, Sol Ring, and Library of Alexandria would never be printed today, and especially not at uncommon. Skullclamp was clearly a huge mistake.
All these cards technically uncommons, but really not designed in any way that you would expect an uncommon to look these days. We're going to pack one, pick one from that cube. It is a little bit different in terms of sizing and packs. So it's designed for 2 to 4 players to draft, and the draft format is 4 packs of 10. And then from that pool of 40 cards, we are expected to build a deck with a minimum of 30 cards. I don't think that's far enough off from the typical, quote-unquote, typical 40-card decks that it's going to affect my specific card evaluations, but I think that was just a factor of the size of the cube that Nate was looking to build and perhaps the things he was trying to support at Singleton. Do you have any thoughts about this cube before we dive into our Pack 1, Pick 1, Anthony?
I'll sort of prefix it by saying, in addition to knowing your strengths and being able to play into them, it's also really good to know where your weaknesses are. And playing with combo decks and these really, like, structured kinds of interactions is not something I super enjoy, so it's not something I have a ton of experience with, so I'm prepared to be challenged here.
Our pack is Kitesail Freebooter, Merchant Scroll, Saheeli Sublime Artificer, Eladomri's Call, Mystic Sanctuary, Sylvan Library, God Pharaoh's Statue, Stitchwing Scob, Lotus Petal, and Shriekhorn. So again, a pack of 10, and we are looking to take a card out of this pack to build a somewhat broken combo-oriented peasant deck. So what's it going to be, Anthony?
So I think I sort of want to break this pack into 3 different chunks, and I'm curious if you agree. One chunk is actual combo pieces, which seems pretty straightforward. So we have stuff like Saheeli and presumably God Pharaoh's Gift, and I'm assuming Stitchwing Scab and Shriekhorn fall into that category too. And that's part where it's like you really sort of need to know the environment when it is so combat-focused. Combo-focused.
Because the opposite of combat.
You don't really know exactly how these cards are going to function without that specific knowledge. But we can sort of assume that that's what they're here for. The other category, which we don't see a ton of in this pack, is Disruption. But we have a Kitesail Freebooter, which seems like it's going to be really effective to stop someone else's combo. And then the last piece is sort of like redundancy and card advantage, the cards that are just going to help you get to your combos. So we have a Tutor and Merchant Scroll, we have Sylvan Library, which is going to dig us through our deck and get us a bunch of extra cards, and Eladomri's Call, which is another tutor for creatures. I think because I'm not super confident in how those combos fit together yet at this point, I'm leaning towards taking the disruptive element in Kitesail Freebooter, or just a really strong card advantage engine that's going to dig for whatever combo we end up with in Sylvan Library. I think for me it's going to be one of those two, and I'm leaning towards Sylvan Library just because on raw power level, it's really a standout here, I think.
Yeah, I think people know these cards, but I'll just read them for posterity. Sylvan Library is 1 and a green for an enchantment, and the actual rules text is, at the beginning of your draw step, you may draw 2 additional cards. If you do, choose 2 cards from your hand drawn this turn. For each of these cards, pay 4 life or put the card on top of your library. In a combo-focused environment, I would say this card is basically one and a green to draw three cards every turn, pretty much. Because
right, if you can either combine it with fetch lands or their shuffle effects, obviously it just gives you a lot of card selection. But if you're not under pressure from your opponents that are playing aggressive decks, if everybody's just playing these combo decks, you can actually afford to pay a good chunk of life into it.
Right, and if you're going to win that turn, you'll pay down to one life, right? Who cares? Oh, totally, yeah. playing burn or whatever. So definitely a very high ceiling on that as a card advantage and card selection engine. And the Kitesail Freebooter is one and a black for the 1/2 with flying that when it enters the battlefield, you exile a non-creature, non-land card from your opponent underneath of it until it leaves the battlefield. So the little modern version of Mesmeric Fiend, which I think plays quite a bit better than the original Mesmeric Fiend. Anthony, I'm just going to take Lotus Petal here. That's 0 mana for an artifact that you can sacrifice for a mana of any color. My reasoning is that I don't know this cube very well, and none of these other cards are standing out to me as very obvious power level outliers, which is on our theme I think we're going to talk about later. And also none of them are standing out as like totally essential combo pieces, right? If I were to see something like a Storm payoff or a Dredge payoff in this pack, those are two things that I know this cube supports. I mean, really top tier ones. Like, for example, you mentioned the Stitchwing Scab. That, I believe, is in there for the Dredge deck, but it seems to me like a very like C-level card for the Dredge deck, not the reason to be in the Dredge deck. The Stitchwing Scab is a 3 and a blue for a 3/1 with flying, but the relevant text is you can pay 1 and a blue to discard 2 cards to return it from your graveyard to the battlefield tapped. None of these cards are standing out to me as like the things that are pulling you into any of their combos, and while I agree that Freebooter is a pretty good piece of disruption and probably among one of the better disruptive creatures in the cube, and Sylvan Library does have a very high ceiling for card draw, I think I'm just going to start on Lotus Petal and see what the next pack has for me, because Lotus Petal, it's very swingy. I think under the best circumstances, Lotus Petal plays like a 0 mana time walk, in that you just get to play a turn ahead for a turn, which in combo-oriented games oftentimes means you just end the game a turn sooner than you would have otherwise, which means it plays out a lot like a time walk. Obviously, if you draw it late in the game, it's just a much worse land, which is a pretty bad spot to be, much worse basic land, though it does mana fix, obviously. But it is colorless, and if I'm planning to do anything unfair, anything storm-related, anything, AB combo-related, then I will be very happy to have a Lotus Petal in my deck. So I'm going to start there and see where the wind blows.
Yeah, it definitely has a high ceiling, and similar to sort of the changes in the combo-focused environment that we talked about with the Sylvan Library, card advantage is also likely to be not the critical thing that games are going to hinge upon. It's not like, are you going to block your bear with my bear, and you're going to use a combat trick and get up a card, and like those are not the interactions we're looking for. We're just trying to get something broken together, and getting your broken thing together a turn ahead can definitely win you the game.
I do think this is a really cool cube, I think, for Tinker. Tinker isn't uncommon. Hilariously. I mean, what a ridiculous block of magic cards the Urza's block was. So Tinker is, the iconic broken artifact tutor that just puts artifact directly into play. But at peasant power level, you are severely limited on what you can actually get with Tinker. I think the Godfarer statue we're looking at here is probably one of the premier Tinker targets. We also have stuff like Sphinx of the Guild Pact and Sandstone Oracle, which are perfectly reasonable and very early in the game will likely do quite a bit towards ending the game in your favor. But we're not talking about tinkering into Blithesteel Colossus, which I think makes Tinker all the more interesting in this environment.
It really highlights how much Magic design philosophy has changed. And the fact that if you have these hard restrictions, like saying only uncommons, yeah, that's meaningful. It's based on some data, but it's not really in the spirit of saying, well, we want to play these uncommon power level cards.
Yeah, well, I think about that, but it's also true that like there were broken things at every rarity level back then. It's really just that yeah, Magic has changed so much over the years. It's not really so much that their approach to uncommons has changed, it's their approach to all Magic cards has changed so dramatically since they were printing stuff in the Urza's block that rarity is kind of just a coincidence at that point. When you look at cards that old, rarity does not mean what it means today.
One more question about this cube. Is Book of Ross a real Magic card?
I was looking at that too as I was looking through here for Tinker targets. Book of Ross is 6 mana for an artifact. Pay 2 and 2 life to draw a card. I can't tell. It doesn't say mono artifact, so I don't think you have to tap it, but it's from the dark, so for all I know, you might have to tap it. That's a little wild to me. I would not even be excited to tinker into that, because we're talking about a card advantage engine that's quite overcosted and slow, and in order to get it into playoff tinker, you've already gone down a ton of cards, so it's like, okay, I tinker out Book of Ross. So I 3-for-1 myself to get this Book of Ross in play. So now I'm even on cards until I have to draw 2 more cards to break even on cards, and then I can start generating value. Comparing that to something like Sylvan Library, I don't think I'm looking to play Book of Ross in this environment.
Yeah, and I've just never seen this card before.
Neither have I. Another beautiful thing about Cube, you get to see stuff you've never seen before. Thank you for sending in this cube, Nate. I think it's really interesting looking. It reminds me a little bit of the Degenerate Micro Cube, and then it is a smaller cube, and it's focused on combos, but obviously the rarity restrictions mean we're looking at very different combinations of cards, and yeah, I'd be curious to see how this would play out. I am not confident at all in my evaluation of any of the cards in this cube or that pack, but that's why I'm taking a nice safe Lotus Petal to go easy. And Anthony, taking that Sylvan Library, drawing a bunch of cards.
And if you want to tell us we were wrong, send in your comments about what we should have taken.
Yeah, I mean, Nate is on the record as we're sending in voice recordings. So, Nate, if you want to record a little diatribe about how we messed up, maybe we'll publish it. No promises. If you want to have your cube on Lucky Paper Radio, you can send it to mail@luckypaper.co with your name and pronouns, and we will do a pack one, pick one on the show. All right, Anthony, we've all been waiting with bated breath. Introduce us to what you want to talk about with regards to power level and power level disparity within a cube.
So this is just something that I think comes up in any conversation I've ever been part of about any particular cube. And I don't think often we really contextualize it in terms of like what it actually means and like how we design around it. It's often just sort of presented as here's a fact and possibly with some value judgment. So I'm curious to get a little bit of your opinion on what you think about what this actually does. But what we're talking about is the disparity in power level. So if we're looking at a cube, not all cards are created equal. There are just going to be some cards that are more powerful than others. Like often when we think about cube is the idea that compared to a retail limited set, the power level is quite flat, but there's still going to be some disparity. And the degree of that disparity, whether you have a pretty close sort of band of everything's in a similar range or a very wide range. You know, here's a 3-mana 2/2 in the same pack as a Black Lotus or, you know, a Jitte, something very powerful. It's just something that I see people cite so often. What do you think it actually matters?
I agree. When I was first introduced to Cube, one of the main defining features that was pitched to me was flat power level or flatter power level. I do think it's worth noting that we've talked about how on this show, for a lot of people, that Magic Online Vintage Cube is Cube, right? It's the most iconic cube. It's the cube they know. Probably not that many listeners of our show, but to a lot of people, nonetheless, that's the iconic cube. And I actually think in that cube, it's not that much flatter than a retail limited set, right? Like, the difference between Black Lotus and, like, Baneslayer Angel, I don't think is that different than the difference between, I don't know, Goldspan Dragon and some D-minus sideboard card or card you don't want to play in Call Time Limited. So that sort of core assumption that Cube is about having a flat power level or aspiring to a flat power level, I don't think is actually true for as many cubes as most people first think.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, really good example that I think it's quite clear.
Black Lotus is better than Baneslayer Angel. And Gold,
I mean,
Dragon,
you just wanted to take out of this pick a third of a Black Lotus. Would you ever pick a third of a Baneslayer Angel?
What is a third of a Baneslayer Angel? Like Aerial Responder?
Protection from Deem.
Protection from Dem. Dem as in, you know, like them. But yeah, anyway, protection from Dem over Dare.
That's the joke.
My goal with my own cube for a long time was to flatten the power level as much as possible. But my main cube is playing a lot of very powerful cards. Now, I'm not playing power, but I am playing stuff like Umezawa's Jitte and Skullclamp and Ancient Tomb, and there are not 360 cards, even close to it, that are within the same tier of power level as those cards that I can ever really achieve a truly flat power level. So for me, a long time, my cube design was about trying to flatten the power level as much as possible while still playing these powerful cards I wanted to play, which ostensibly meant raising the bar so that all of the cards in my cube were as powerful as they could be to bring them as close to this theoretical line that these outliers that I really wanted to play were setting. And I remember when you made one of the very first iterations of your cube, I have a very distinct memory of it. Your main cube, again, is lower power level, so you can explore more interesting synergies and themes than are available if you're playing at the limits of power. And I think one of the very first versions of your cube succeeded so tremendously at having a flat power level that I remember doing some pack one pick ones and being like, I actually feel like my decision doesn't really matter. Like, there's half of this pack is totally viable to take. Nothing is screaming out above anything else. And so it's almost like choose your own adventure. Like, all right, take whatever I want. My first couple picks are kind of throwaways. And then I maybe see what's open based on what's passed to me. But I actually remember having, for the first time, with your cube, thinking like, oh, actually, you know what? Maybe a perfectly flat power level, this ideal that a lot of cube designers describe that they're aiming for, is not actually that good. Because if you achieve it, what you end up doing is eliminating a lot of the decisions you make in drafting and deck building that are actually interesting because of that disparity in one way or another. And obviously, a perfectly flat power level is both impossible because Magic cards aren't created equal. Like, there are no two cards that are created equal except for functional duplicates in Magic history. You know, we could sit here and talk about the very subtle differences between sleight of hand and Serum Visions and why there is sometimes we want one and sometimes we want the other, and they're not actually perfectly even though they're functionally pretty similar. So it's really impossible to have a flat power level. And if you were to achieve it, the impacts on the draft, I think, are not what people that are aiming for that tend to expect. So all that is to say that for me, I have come to recognize people talking about shooting for a flat power level. I think that only really applies when you are at the limits of power and are embracing some level of guaranteed not flat power level because you're playing very powerful cards that are naturally outliers. And once you're designing a cube in any other context, I think that's actually a very important decision you make as a designer, is how much disparity do I want and why, and what do I want the power outliers to be, as opposed to having those decisions kind of made for you by playing at the limits of power.
Yeah, I think that was a really interesting sort of experience in our sort of cube design philosophy as a local play group, as we were, you know, everybody kind of dove in at the same time designing their own cubes, and we kind of realized, oh wait, this sort of like conventional wisdom doesn't maybe actually pan out the way we expected when we're targeting this lower power level where we actually do have the flexibility to really, really commit to it. And just to put a big caveat on all of this, we're talking about power level of cards. This is a totally abstract concept, and obviously every card's power level is extremely, extremely dependent on the context you're putting it in, but we're just gonna roll with it. We're just gonna talk about it abstractly, and that's gonna be fine.
Well, yeah, I don't want to get pedantic about it. Well, at least not too pedantic. But I would actually argue that power level in the terms we're trying to describe is not actually an abstract concept. I think, you know, give us time-traveling supercomputer, you could look at every pack and say, here's the card that would maximize the win percentage, and that is, by that definition, the most powerful card in the pack. Now, obviously, that changes based on the pack, based on what you've already drafted, based on all kinds of variables, but I do actually think that it is a concrete thing. It's just way too complicated for us to ever know, and so we have to talk about it in abstract, removed terms, because we can't possibly ever really know what those win percentages are. We can only speculate as to what they might be.
Sure. Okay, I'll concede that. So power level is context-dependent, and it is an unattainable number, but we will suss it out based on our, or we'll approximate it based on our past experience with cards. Fair enough?
I guess what I'm really trying to head off at the pass is I've heard some people before, I've actually made this mistake myself in the past too, basically refer to power level as subjective, because it's really complicated and unknowable, it's very tempting to say, oh, it's just up to subjectivity. But it's actually not, I don't think. I think it is an objective thing. It's just that we can't know what that objective thing is. But that doesn't make it any less concrete or real. We just can't possibly describe it. We don't have the technology.
I think what you laid out about the fact that a flat power level doesn't always work either makes a lot of sense. So I kind of want to try and, yeah, suss out what are the actual impacts of a wide or narrow band of power level. I think it's something that people often latch onto because cubes are so different. Everybody has such different goals. It can be really hard to identify anything about a cube if someone just says, hey, give me some feedback. One of the objective things that you can point to is, well, it's interesting to see card A and card B in the same pack, because it's going to be so easy for me to just always take card A because it's so much more powerful. And I think that is meaningful, but the actual reason it is meaningful is because of those choices that you're making, especially during a draft. You mentioned that in a pack with a perfectly even power level, it's very hard to make a choice because you almost don't have a choice. Whatever you take is going to add to your win percentage equally. And the other issue on the other extreme is that if you have an extremely high disparity in power level, the picks are going to be easy because you're just going to take those power outliers. So if we're talking about something like the MTGO Vintage Cube, you just take the Black Lotus every time and you're effectively eliminating choices. So that's meaningful.
Your picks are forced unless you're trying to do something cute.
And where that matters is if specifically your goal for your cube is to add as much complexity to each of those decisions as possible, which I think for both of us is a goal for our own cube designs, but is only really meaningful if that's the case.
Yes, and it touches on a thing we've discussed briefly in the past, which is that I think some cube designers are often thinking about their cube and their design decisions are made in the context of gameplay. They're thinking about, what are the viable decks in my environment? What do their matchups look like? Is this individual card too powerful once it resolves or if it's cast? They're thinking about things in terms of the game and all the decisions that happen there. But there's also a whole other aspect of cube design, which is the experience drafting the cube. And I have seen some cubes, for example, like some cubes that break Singleton and really strongly avoid any kind of conditional effects. They're like only playing cards that are always good and that are very flexible. And in those cubes, I do feel like they are prioritizing the gameplay and not the draft experience. Because if all the cards are good in every single game state and there's a huge, they're all low CMC, so it's not like risky to take anything that costs, you know, 4 mana or whatever. And, you know, there's tons of fixing, so you can always get mana that casts your spells. It's not that drafting is not difficult, right? There's still all kinds of decisions to make about your density of threats versus interaction and what your curve looks like in your draft deck. But it certainly becomes much easier to draft a functional deck. I think a lot of cube designers want to make it as easy as possible for their players to draft a functional deck because they want to have good games of Magic. But I do think that a cost of that, which is very rarely mentioned, is that if you make it too easy to draft a functional deck, then a lot of the decisions in the draft are significantly minimized. And it's just a trade-off you make, right? Where it's like, now, you know, all these cards are playable. I'm not going to be short playables because there are no cards in my color that I won't play because they're all flexible and good in every board state or whatever. And you end up in a situation where the draft is really more about, like, which colors are open? Am I going to be 3 colors or 2 colors or whatever? But it's not really about making evaluations about what effects, you know, your deck needs and trying to identify powerful outliers.
All those things you just said make sense, but I'll disagree that it only applies to the draft. So part of what you just said is that, you know, looking to try and balance the details of get the right number of effects, balance your curve, all these kinds of things. And I definitely agree that's another factor that comes into play. If there's a huge disparity in cards, the kind of like minor synergistic or like fine tuning of your deck kind of tends to get drowned out by just take these bombs. And I think that actually does impact both the draft experience, but the play experience as well. If the games tend to revolve around just who draws their bomb, you don't have the opportunity for these little edges in the draft and in gameplay. So I think that that's another sort of, if your goal for your cube is to really, really appeal to spikes, where people who are really interested and engaged in trying to make these small decisions and make these tiny edges, that's a really good reason. That's a goal to have, where saying, well, having a flat power level is a positive for this cube because that is my goal.
And also, you know, in those situations, the draft decisions are still real. It's just that the percentage difference in win percentage is much smaller delta, right? So it's like, does my deck want a 4th really flexible removal spell or a 7th really efficient threat? And knowing which one of those it is, you know, might, if we had our time traveling supercomputer, know that we're changing our win percentage by 2.5% or whatever, and then you're only going to play 3 matches with that deck, and so the chances of that 2.5% actually changes the outcome of a game is very small, but those are the kinds of small edges that really competitively minded players like to play in, right? Like, I oftentimes talk to my neighbors or friends that don't play Magic, and they want to know what's interesting about the game, or if they can watch a match and, like, understand what's fun about it. And what I always tell them is, like,
that's one of the biggest problems with Magic, to be honest.
It really, truly is, and it's, you know, we don't like to just be negative on this show, but I do think that Wizards pursuing Magic as an e-sport, like a spectator thing, I think it's just so misguided, because I love Magic, but it's a horrible spectator sport. Like, if you're an excellent Magic player, watching an incredible Magic player do something amazing is watching a player over the course of a whole weekend make the 2% better decision 100 times in a row, or with slightly higher likelihood than their opponents.
Yeah, I mean, I'll disagree. I don't think it's like a misguided decision, but it is a much harder spectator sport. And actually, I think they talked about this a couple weeks ago on Limited Resources. By a couple weeks ago, maybe it was a year. What is time these days? How it's, you need to have all that context. And if you're an engaged player that understands the game and you're willing to watch a whole game, a whole match, you can see, oh, well, they ended up doing those 2 points of damage on turn three that they could have, they're arguably shouldn't have done because it gave up some information or some resource. And then it ended up mattering and that's why they won the game. But if they lost, you wouldn't really see that. Like, it's not as fun to just sit there and say, like, okay, you cast the spell and it whiffed. And so now you lost the game, but understanding, well, it was still the right choice in that particular game versus watching like most sports where you see they made the shot, they got the shot, they got a point, they win. And it's like much easier to grok that one moment in isolation.
Right. I mean, incredible moments in regular sports and esports, other esports, are about dexterity and like it's a physical performance. Like if you watch somebody playing competitive Super Smash Brothers, right? Like that is a performance that they are capable of doing, and there isn't much variance in play there. So they're actually doing something incredible physically. Like, it's a physical accomplishment. Whereas like if you go on YouTube and like Google like most iconic magic moments in history, it's all just people getting good luck. Like it's just you top deck the Lightning Helix, you laid out your Cruel Ultimatum mana and you drew Cruel Ultimatum. It's just a long series of people getting lucky, which is not what's great about magic.
It's not Ben Stark saying, I'm not going to cast anything and just activate Slimefoot.
Right. And I'll push back a little bit on what you said, because I am a pretty invested magic player, as you know. And just to, again, call back to PV's YouTube page, my favorite videos of his he's done a couple of videos where he walks through his thought process on a turn or a series of turns in a competitive game he's playing. And, you know, the turn in the real game took 35 seconds, 60 seconds, but he makes a 30-minute video about it and talks about all the decisions he was making and trying to think through. And I agree, in theory, if I was able to follow that fast enough to actually think all those things and then say, wow, PV made that choice when he considered all these things, then I might be able to enjoy it on that like heady theoretical level. But I don't think any human being can. The coverage can't keep up. Like the decisions are happening so fast that like I like watching competitive magic. But what I like watching competitive magic for is not these amazing spectator moments. It's like I want to see how cards interact. I want to watch games play out. I want to see how this meta is evolving. I'm not tuning in to see this amazing performance, because I still think the amazing performances are extremely boring. It's tedious, correct decision-making drawn out over, you know, a whole tournament. But either way, all that is to say that, yes, I think if you are trying to cater to very spiky players, then minimizing those choices, I don't mean to minimize this and make them, I mean minimize this and make them less important. So like if you open a Black Lotus in your Magic Online Vintage Cube pack, taking that Black Lotus might rocket your win percentage by 10% or something. If you open a pack full of bog playables, then one of those cards is going to have a 0.5% higher win percentage. And if navigating those waters is what's interesting for you and your playgroup, then I think a flatter power level is relevant.
I think the flatter power level, more than just, you know, what you said is true, that it is a matter of like the big decisions are so much bigger in terms of impacting your win percentage than the small ones that it makes them less relevant. But I also think it just means that the interactions between cards become less important. You know, me combining a Black Lotus with anything else that I can cast is
something
much
that costs
stronger.
Four mana on turn one.
Yeah, then me navigating all these details of, well, I want these two C-minus cards that fit together to add up to something a little bit better than that. I think that those decisions are not just drowned out, but actively, you know, just don't exist anymore in a lot of cases if there's a really huge disparity.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there is a certain degree to which you can't always rely on drawing your Black Lotus, so you only have a couple really big power standouts, and obviously you're going to want them, but then the rest of your deck still has to work in some other fashion. So I don't think that having power outliers totally negates these kind of synergistic interactive picks you're describing, where you
sure, I mean, everything we're talking about is matters of degrees. The time-traveling supercomputer is not, well, it is binary, I guess. You know what I mean.
It's a computer. That's how computers
work. It's a quantum
computer. We're not going to have a time-traveling supercomputer until we have quantum computing, so we can say it's quantum. Something that this is related to, which I think is one of the biggest holes in my game as a player, is that power level is obviously not fixed, right? So some cards are a pretty strong, like a pretty consistent baseline. Serum Visions is always pretty good. It's never busted, and it's never a total dud, because even if Serum Visions draws you a land and scries two more lands to the bottom when you had nothing else to do, that still moved through three lands on top of your library, right? Like, Serum Visions has got a very narrow band of power, and it's just very solid. Any kind of build around, I'm looking at my own cube and looking at stuff like Monastery Mentor or Stoneforge Mystic. These cards have a huge individual power level band, right? Like, that card has a very high ceiling, but also a very low floor. If I already drew and played my one equipment in my deck, Stoneforge Mystic is now just a 2-mana 1/2, right? Like, it doesn't do anything. Or if I, you know, get it late in a draft and I have no equipment in my draft pool, then I can't even really take it. The card does nothing for my deck. Given that factor, I think one of my biggest pitfalls as a player is that I am often unwilling to commit to the potential of a build around synergy that is risky in the draft. And I think this comes up a lot in your own cube. I'm not the best at playing your cube. This has come up over and over again. And I think one of the things is, if I'm looking at a pack with some synergistic build around that has the potential to be one of the best cards in the pack, if I'm able to get some other cards in my deck, not only draft them, but draw them at the right time and combine them to make a more powerful interaction, I'm always looking at that and going, ah, but risky. I'm just going to take the Serum Visions instead. And then at the end of the day, in your cube, I end up with a deck full of Serum Visionses, and my deck is a very solid C+, but anybody else that has any kind of synergies very quickly makes their cards worth much more than the sum of their parts in ways that I can't. And it's not that at the end of the draft, I look at your deck and say, oh, that's too risky. Once I look at your deck, I'm like, yeah, your deck's way better than mine. Look at all these crazy, cool combinations you have. It's that when it's broken down to the individual pick level, I have a very hard time looking at the pack and saying, yeah, I'll take this Traxos. This will pay off, surely. Like, that is the thing I really struggle with. And so that's another element to this, is even if your cards are all, if the mean power level of all your cards, the average power level could be a very narrow band still, right? Like, let's just say, theoretically, right, that Serum Visions and Traxos on the long arc of history have the same effect on win percentage, right? They're going to, after 100,000 games, they're both going to affect your win percentage by the same percentage. They're the same power level card by this model we're describing. That doesn't mean that they perform the same way in the draft, because they present you with a different amount of variance, and that changes your further draft picks by another different amount, which means that you can have a theoretically flat power level with still lots of dynamic decisions to make in the draft portion of the game.
Yeah, and I take that as a tremendous compliment, by the way.
That I suck at your cube?
No, just the way that you describe the way it plays out is very much in line with my goals.
Yeah, I think you have achieved those goals pretty well. I need to, like, I don't know, I gotta, like, do some psychedelics or something to, like, reset my brain chemistry so I can actually draft your cube in the way it's meant to be drafted, because I just look at the pack and I'm like, no, I'll just take this burn spell because it'll always work.
Well, hold on. The whole cube might change tremendously.
Oh?
Let's get to that later. So, all that we've talked about up to this point is really how a flat power level is great if your goal is to maximize decisions, maximize the complexity of the choices that your players have in the game. The other big area I think it's important is in variation. If you have a cube that has a huge variation in power level, you're going to end up seeing the more powerful cards much more often, and the less powerful cards are just going to end up in people's sideboards. So right. Similarly, if your goal is to maximize the amount of variation you see in gameplay, the number of different decks that you can possibly have drafted, limiting that band of power level as much as possible is really going to help you do that.
And something we've talked about before is that not only do those power outliers show up more because they're the most powerful cards and they just get played more and get main decked more, they also drive the draft. So I've mentioned that I had Oko in my cube for 9 months, maybe 10 months, maybe a little more than 9 months. And when Oko is in my cube, I think it was one of the most powerful cards, pretty clearly. I think it's up there with your Ancient Tombs and your Skull Clamps and your Umezawa's Jitte's and stuff. And when it was in my cube, there was never a single draft where there wasn't exactly a blue-green player. And that's just because people see that card and they're like, well, I have to play it. And obviously, Oko's totally fine to splash. I'll splash it in my green-black deck or whatever, my blue-black deck. But it just never happened that way because people saw this powerful card and said, I have to play this card. And that affected the rest of their draft decisions and deck building decisions such that there was always a blue-green deck, no matter what. And so really big power outliers can also drive things in that way. It's like, well, if you have three really good power outliers that are only good in mono red, like there's going to be a mono red drafter every single time, basically, because those cards are enough better than the rest of the cube that they're going to essentially dictate how your players draft every single time.
Totally. And I think the way that that specific sort of, the way that the variance impacts the optimal draft strategies can shake out in a lot of different ways. One of the ways that it can also shake out in especially lower power environments is if there's a bigger delta in power level, taking more powerful cards in more different colors, if there isn't like, you know, a very fast deck that you know you have to be prepared to fight against, is just going to be a much more, you're going to end up with a lot more powerful cards in your deck if you're willing to stretch for more colors. So I often think, you know, people are concerned about, well, I don't want to add too much fixing because it's going to enable these like five color good stuff piles.
Five color good stuff.
But really, and this has also been very much my experience with my own environment, the way to sort of address that five color good stuff pile is just to tighten in that curve so people aren't actually getting the reward for stretching into more and more colors.
That one I'm not totally sure on. So I agree that one of the main ways to curb that five-color good stuff deck, if it is a goal of yours to curb the five-color good stuff deck, which is not a goal of everybody's, but if you don't like that greedy deck, I agree that diminishing the reward for being in that deck is the way to do that. I am not convinced that it is by narrowing the power level band that you succeed in that, because one of the things that I think happens is if you do have a very narrow power level band and you're top 25 best cards are not that much better than your bottom 25 worst cards, then that incentivizes a player to say, I'm just going to take fixing, because all these cards are pretty much as good as all the other cards, so I'm just going to take fixing, and then the cards I get in the middle of the pack are going to be no worse than the cards my other opponents are first picking, and there's no punishment for me for taking this fixing very highly. I do think that very often the power outliers end up being gold cards. And if your power outliers are all gold cards, then I do think you really are pushing that multicolored deck, because if someone's not exactly in that color pair, they can't play the card at all unless they are playing some sort of greedy pile. And so it's not that you're going to get a mono blue card late and be like, oh, great, I can take this blue card and this will go in my four color, five color deck. And that's the payoff for me being in this deck. I think it's when those power outliers overlap with gold cards, which are already difficult for other players to take, right? Any other blue player will take the powerful blue card. But if you have a powerful Izzet card, you got to be playing Izzet or one of these greed piles to take it. And I think that's where that payoff comes in.
I don't know. I mean, I agree these things are all related. Like, I think some of the big sort of variables, the knobs that you can turn are the power level disparity, the sort of average tempo, like how quickly are you expecting to be under pressure in the given environment, and how much fixing is available. I think these are all really, really related to what the optimal draft strategy looks like. But I do think that variance is really, really important. Like, and I think it plays out even without gold cards. Your example of saying, well, I'll just take fixing and it doesn't really matter if I'm not getting the top, top, top tier cards because they're not that much better. Like, then you're taking fixing. If you're using that fixing to splash for additional colors, you're really not getting any extra value out of it.
That is true. I think it's, I guess maybe it's more about the overall, what that overall power level curve looks like, and less just how much better are the outliers, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, it's not linear. It's a complicated right, exactly. Bell curve. And so we're generalizing a lot, but yeah, I mean, I think that these are just useful things to think about and sort of tools to think about how these different factors of an environment influence the kind of gameplay you have, but it's not the answer. It's just a set of tools that you need to apply as needed.
Right, because like, if players in one or two color decks that are not being greedy are, by the nature of this curve of power level, forced to play, you know, what are Ds in this environment, like because they just didn't get any other red cards, they have to play these Ds, but they get to play also the A's and the A pluses. If you, by taking fixing, get to play all B's and C's, then you might be in a better spot if those D's are much worse than the B's and C's. But if the D's are really not that much worse than B's and C's, then yeah, it's like I'm not actually getting any additional value from splashing. So I almost wonder if the five-color greedy deck is more a factor of how bad are the worst cards rather than how good are the best cards, because the best cards are the ones that are going to go highly no matter who's taking them. I'm not sure you're going to get too many of the best cards in a cube unless, again, they're gold cards as the five-color drafter. But you will get to avoid all of the worst cards because you just never take the awful card. You always take the better card in a different color, no matter what stage of the draft you're at.
That's fair. I mean, there's this really ambiguous sort of metric. I wonder if we could create about how many non-lands you actually end up with in your sideboard. Because if you are playing a format where maybe there's not as much fixing and people are really willing to dedicate to find their lane, which means you end up just getting a bunch of on-color cards, maybe you just have a thicker sideboard so you're not as concerned about those bad cards making it to your deck because they won't. Or, you know, in these different cube variations we've talked about, people are getting a little bit more willing to test out, you know, either just amping up the number of fixing to a huge degree where you end up not having that many cards in your sideboard, or just altering the number of cards in packs.
This is actually a concept I've been thinking a lot about. You know that I have a forthcoming article about density of mana fixing and lands in a cube, which, I don't know, give me a month or something, people. I don't know. At some point it'll be done. But one of the things that we did there is crunch some numbers on actual draft decks to try and figure out how many on-color cards are draft decks not playing. And I do think that is, in many ways, the most important design space you actually have as a cube designer, where it's like, all right, people are going to draft, let's, you know, take a typical cube. People are drafting 15-card packs. They're building 40-card decks. You're going to have some number of cards that your players are not main decking in their colors. And the question is, what are you doing with that space? Because if those are just the worst cards in the cube, and those are the ones people are never playing, then the answer is you're not doing anything with that space. You're squandering it because these are just the worst cards people aren't playing in those colors. If those cards are largely sideboard cards and contextual, then you have really prioritized as a cube designer giving your opponents flexible sideboard options so that games two and three of their matches look a lot different than game one, which is a virtue you can pursue. Or you could go way heavier on fixing, which is why I dug into these numbers to specifically look at how much fixing a cube can support, and just say, well, if these are just cards that aren't going to get played anyway, let's just give them more fixing lands so that their main deck is much better. Because obviously, you can always add more fixing lands into a main deck. You hit a cap of how many non-land cards you can run, but you can always run more lands. So that's a way to diminish your sideboard size as well. I think it would be, I would love to work with you to come up with like some language to describe this space that you're working with and help people really grasp what that space is doing in their environment. Because I do think it's actually like where some of the most interesting decisions about how the environment plays can be made.
And it's sort of the least visible space too.
It is. It really is. And another thing that ends up in this space, I think this comes up a lot in your cube, is just cards that are on color that are not bad cards, but they're just build arounds I was not able to build around, right? You know, you have a lot of these synergistic cards where sometimes I'm in black red, but I get to this pack three and I get handed this black card that's a perfectly powerful card, but it doesn't fit with my black red strategy because I didn't have the particular payoffs for it. And so that's another type of variety you can prioritize with this space. And crunching some numbers on this can actually tell you how much space you have available. Like, how much space can you commit to cards that players in those colors will often not main deck because they didn't build around them correctly or didn't have a chance to draft around them, which allows for tons of variety, right? If those cards are powerful and you get them in pack one, then you get to draft whole different decks even in the same color pair, but at the cost of basically thinning your draft pool some percentage of the time.
For me, that's kind of the perfect solution for the kind of gameplay I'm looking for and the kind of drafting I'm looking for. That's the ideal way to activate that space, is to say all of these cards can come up in some games, but they just won't always be relevant because you need to build around them a little bit. And so because of that, you end up with seeing a lot more different unique cards and unique decks because some of them will fit in some of the times. I need to cup up a conjurer, don't I? I'm just saying this and I'm living a lot.
You know, you have like a 400 plus card cube. You keep it in there forever because it's your icon. It's your little familiar. I went through my cube recently. I was trying to think of a name to describe what I really should have just gone with build arounds. Build arounds is really the name people know, but I was not specifically looking for just traditional build arounds. I was looking for any card that wouldn't be happily main decked in 90% of the decks drafted of that color. So like, you know, if you're playing white in my cube, most of the white creatures you'll put in any white deck, but some of them you won't, right? Like, you won't just put Monastery Mentor in any white deck. If you're like a creature heavy mono white aggro deck, you don't want Monastery Mentor. You won't put Thalia, frankly, in any white deck. Like, you could have a blue white control deck or whatever. It's just not playing Thalia. Stoneforge Mystic is another example that came up. I ended up going through and tagging the cards I thought were these kind of build arounds. I tagged them as diverters, as like it like changes your path through the draft. I don't think it's the best word.
You're kind of trying to solve this problem by creating another bucket. We talk about things in terms of build arounds because we need to put things in labels so we can talk about them. But really, like everything, it's a spectrum. the things that we usually label as build arounds are on the extreme end, where they do potentially absolutely nothing unless you put them in a deck with certain other cards. And on the other end is cards that don't really interact with other things. You know, it's a removal spell. It just works. And then there's everything else in between, where depending on what you've drafted and you already have in your pool, your evaluation of that card might go up or down a little bit.
Right, and this is why, like, I was hesitant to put him in a bucket, because the bucket is a binary. It's either tagged a diverter or it's not. But I thought it was useful just to visualize for myself, like, and the best example for me is just board wipes, right? So my white section of my cube has the most creatures, I'm pretty sure. Or yeah, tied with green for the most creatures. It's mostly creatures in my white section, fair number of planeswalkers, a fair number of removal spells, but then it also has three board wipes. And it's like, all right, well, once I take one or more of these board wipes in the draft, my draft is changed completely. I am no longer prioritizing a third of the white cards in this cube because I don't want to be playing these creatures in my board wipe heavy deck. So to me, it's like the natural thrust of white in my cube is proactive white creatures or and planeswalkers. Like, I'm just trying to, and whether that's aggro or some form of mid-range, like, I think most of these cards can fit in both decks, right? Like, you'll play a Fairy Godmother in a mid-range deck. It's fine. Like, it gets the job done. So there's, like, a thrust of the color, and then there's these cards that will, like, divert you from that thrust and say, all right, I'm really powerful, but you have to change it pretty dramatically how you're valuing cards in packs in order to make me work. Another good example of this, even more obvious in the build-around territory, is Opposition. I still have Opposition in my cube. I have 9 blue creatures in my blue section. So if you're playing Opposition...
That's not a lot of creatures.
It's really not. So Opposition is a blue card in the sense that you need blue mana to cast it, but it's way more at home in a green deck or a white deck. And so choosing to take Opposition, you are dramatically altering what your draft is trying to do. Other cards I have in this category are like Young Pyromancer, Craterhoof Behemoth, which I think is like, you have to, it's the one card in my green section that costs more than 5 mana. And so if you want to cast it, you have to specifically go all in on this like big ramp deck. Otherwise, you can't just be a green mid-range deck that plays an 8-drop. You know, Lurrus is a great example of this. I thought the Companions were a really interesting mechanic that explored this territory, where it actually physically restricts your future draft decisions and says you just can't do this other stuff, which makes you get creative with how you play. So Lurrus is a good example. One that's, I think, a different kind of power level is Golos, I think, is a great example of this too, where it's like, all right, this is a fine-ish playable in a mid-ranger controlling deck if you just need a 5 to do something. But for some players, they're going to see that and be like, well, I've already got 4 colors just from my fetches and shocks that I happen to have picked up. Let me just find a way to get this 5th color in here and then turn my deck into a Golos deck, right? And I like having single cards that can completely change your draft like that. But I do think it is restricted design space. And so I wanted these things kind of flagged where it's like, this is a card that you might be in these colors, but get this card late and be unable to take it or unable to play it in your deck. And I want to be aware, just, you know, subconsciously of how many of those I have in each different color combination so that I can think about that when I'm shaping my cube and making cuts and additions.
Yeah, and I think it's important to sort of flag that as, again, or putting it into the context of what your goals are. If your goals are, I want to play fun games where I see splashy cards like Golos go off and really do their thing, then that's great, include it. If your goal is, I want to make even every single decision in Pack 3 to be complex and meaningful, then cards like that you really need to build around in a certain way can take away a little bit of that. You know, unless maybe not. Maybe you have players that are just willing to say, I might get Golos in Pack 3, so here's like a small edge where I can pick up this extra land versus a card that I don't expect to really make my deck, just in case.
Well, right, but because those things can also make later draft picks much more interesting. I get my Golos in my green mid-range deck or whatever. Now, it's maybe I can't just slam this 3-mana Nissa because I actually want to prioritize this other Rampant Growth or other 5-color fixer. Sure. So that I can actually get my 5th mana for Golos. I think for me, these cards are at their best when they increase the kinds of draftable decks and increase the variety of draft decisions you get to make. And so I think the really narrow build arounds where it's like, I mean, honestly, like Lurrus is a good example of the opposite of this. Like Lurrus does not increase your options. It just decreases your options. And by that fact, basically says, all right, you got to go all in aggro and be some combination of white or black. And then you can play this, you get this payoff. I embrace that for different reasons, but the build-arounds I really like are the ones that basically allow you to say, all right, well, before, if I hadn't picked up this build-around, this pick would be pretty straightforward because I would just take the best card of my colors out of this pack. But now that best card is recontextualized by this builder and I know that I already have. And so I have to weigh those decisions basically in each pick.
So I've got one more big point, a low ball. And like everything else about what we've been talking about, it really isn't a good or bad thing to say, yeah, I have like a higher or lower power delta. It's just one more factor to consider and up to you to decide if that's fun or not fun. And it's just that there's going to be more variance. If you're playing an environment where you have some really powerful cards and some cards that are real junkers, sometimes somebody's going to have a bunch of those powerful cards and you're going to feel like you're just losing to the cards. On the other hand, that also means that players have an opportunity to kind of beat any other player. So I think that variance is a really important part of Magic. And to a degree, I definitely embrace it.
It's interesting because that is the log line I've heard about variance. It's like, oh, if you want the lesser player to win more often, then increase the variance. And that's true. But in drafted environments, I think sometimes a delta in power level just means that the best player knows the best cards and other players might not. And then not only do you have the best player sitting down with a slight advantage to the table by being the more skilled or experienced player, but they also have the best deck because they drafted most effectively. And yes, if your delta is wide enough that even your least experienced player can recognize this is the power outlier in this pack and this is what I'm supposed to be doing, then I think you're right. But if the power delta is in any kind of contested territory, which I think for almost all playgroups, that is the case. You know, we have a pack one, pick one channel in the Discord, and it's rare that everyone agrees on the pack one, pick one. And we're talking about environments that are theoretically close to a flat power level or whatever. And so I think as soon as there's any kind of contested idea of what those best cards in the environment are, you might see the opposite of that. You might see dramatically decreased variance because the better player just proves over and over again that this is, in fact, the best strategy and no one else has picked up on it yet.
Yeah, that's fair. And it's also related to, I guess, how obvious those cards are the best cards. If you need to be explained that Moxen are broken, even though they just don't look splashy, yeah, you're definitely going to be in a bad spot. But if your actual power outliers are a 6-mana Grave Titan and even your newer players are excited and recognize that as a powerful card in that given context, I think that I get your point that maybe that logline is a little bit overused, but I think it does apply to some degree.
I mean, it comes up in my own queue. Just today, Jay was once again saying, one of the better players in our playgroup, pulls down a lot of 3-0s in our cube drafts, was saying that, like, yeah, he always forces mono green in my cube if he wants to win. And, like, as a cube designer, I'm like, I don't think mono green is the best deck in my cube necessarily, but Jay does, and Jay puts up good numbers with it and continues to have success. And so it's like, there's contested idea of what the best thing to do in my own cube is, and if we all agreed it was mono green, it would be contested every time that we sat down at the draft table, but we don't because other people are doing other things. And then, you know, Jay wins with mono green. So, yeah, I don't know. It's and to be clear, I don't think he's necessarily right. And yet, results speak for themselves. So it's complicated.
It's too bad we don't have that time traveling supercomputer.
I would love to have a time traveling supercomputer. And if I had it, I think the most important thing to do for humanity would be to figure out these questions about magic. You know?
Oh, for sure.
Forget curing rare diseases and, you know, solving the world economy or whatever. Let's just figure out what actually is the best archetype in my cube. That's what I need to know.
It's time traveling. We don't have to prioritize things because it can just go back in time and do all of them.
Right. First step, figure out the best archetypes in Anthony's cube. Second step, go back in time and kill Hitler.
So do you think that this variance, do you agree sort of in the core concept that a power level does introduce some layer of variance?
Yeah, it definitely does. I think there's so many knobs in question, though, that it's hard to pin down. I do think it adds variance. It certainly adds variety and variance, I think, as well, but definitely variety.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, especially if you're thinking about playing Retail Limited, sometimes you just don't draw one of your three high power outliers, even if, like, everybody has the same number of rares in the deck, the same number of bombs. You're just going to have games where one player draws the more powerful cards.
And if those power outliers didn't exist or were much less of an outlier, then it wouldn't matter that you didn't draw yours and your opponent drew theirs. It wouldn't matter nearly as much.
Right. So the other side of that that I wonder about but don't have really pinned down, and it's definitely going to apply differently to different players, but I wonder how people react to that just in terms of how much they're enjoying the game. Sure, it's fun when you play your bomb, but is it also just like, do you feel like you're just losing to the cube if you draw your bad cards?
Right, or your opponent plays their bomb. You know, it's always fun to play your bomb, but how fun is it to lose to your opponent's bomb?
So I guess the answer is just play your bombs. Draft the good cards.
Anthony, give us a quick rundown, because you're working from some notes here. What were your overall points and takeaways from Power Level? Because I feel like we had a meaningful conversation, but I want to punctuate it with maybe some actionable thoughts for people to apply to their own environment.
All right, so let's work backwards. The last thing we talked about is just higher power level delta. It just leads to higher variance. You'll have some games where you draw your powerful cards and some games where you won't. That can be fun for you, or it cannot be fun for you.
Or some drafts where you open all the powerful cards of the same colors and some drafts where you don't.
Right. The variance in power level will influence what the optimal strategies are. And there are a lot of other factors in play, but it can mean playing more cards in different colors. Or what are the other effects that you mentioned?
Just that big power outliers oftentimes dictate drafts. And one of the very practical ways this comes up for me is that I've seen cube designers say, well, what can I do to make black-white competitive in my cube? And it's like, well, you know, it's really hard to change a whole color pair with just a few cards. But when it's a drafted environment, you really can just stick, like, a power outlier in there. Like, if you can afford to, if you're not already playing at the limits of power level, if you want this deck to do more, or you want to learn more about it, want people to draft it more, just put a couple cards that are a little better than everything else, and that will actually have a big influence on how your players draft the environment.
So the next thing is that minor edges and small decisions can get drowned out by just the variance in the power level of cards. A very broad power level can also mean you have fewer meaningful choices in the draft and see less variation in the way that games actually play out, because you end up seeing the same set of the most powerful cards played and also just have the biggest impact in games and be the cards the games revolve around. And I think that sums us up.
I think this is a good conversation. One of the big takeaways for me in thinking about power level delta is that you only have so much equity, like time you as a cube designer can spend focusing on specific portions of your environment. And I think thinking very consciously about how you want to spend your power level delta, like what you want to spend it on, is one of the most defining features of an environment. So spend more time thinking about what your power outliers are, and if those are the kinds of outliers you want your players to be drafting around and playing around in their games, because those are the cards that are going to decide the more games. And so even though you've got a cube with 360 cards in it or whatever, if you want to narrow it down to, all right, how are games going to end? How are winners and losers going to be decided? It's really looking at those cards that are standing above the rest in terms of power that are going to decide those games most of the time. And so you can have a pretty outsized impact on how games play out with a relatively small number of cards and investing time and really thinking about how you spend that equity.
So I have one more question for you. I think overall we're both on the same page that generally keeping a narrower power level or power band does have a lot of advantages in terms of variation in gameplay and making decisions meaningful. But we also
it's all relative. Like, I would say narrower than Retail Limited and narrower than the Magic Online Cube, sure. But
that's,
there's a lot of cubes
that's exactly
that have a
my question.
Okay.
Retail Limited, which is a horrible name for a thing. Let's say Booster Draft?
Yeah, I mean, I think Booster Draft. I think it's called Booster Draft when you draft fake booster packs from your cube, too.
Well, shit.
That's a draft format to me.
If you're playing Kaldheim or Strixhaven in the near future.
You can call it Set Limited or something.
Set Limited. That's going to be a format that has a huge, huge power delta. You know, you're going to be looking at a pack that has a 3-mana 2/2 and a Bomb Mythic that, you know, does a million things. But I think
what
we're
do
both
I take?
On the same page.
Oofden
that is...
Troll or Koma Cosmos Serpent?
That's a... Exactly. I think you're going to take Koma. But we both still really enjoy playing Limited. And why do you think that Limited doesn't have these same issues, despite having an even more exaggerated power delta?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that it is actually... So, putting power delta aside, the fact that you're opening booster packs makes it much higher variance than a cube. You are not seeing the same cards every time. You can see cards in multiples that you could never see in multiples in a singleton cube. So, there's just way more possible outcomes of cards in the packs when you sit down at a retail draft than any kind of cube draft. Even if you have a big cube, honestly, like there's just way more possibilities there, which makes it interesting. The other thing, frankly,
right. So we don't have the issue of, well, whoever gets GTA and Skull Clamp just like wins and 3-0s the draft every time, because you're only going to get GTA or Skull Clamp every once in a pile of drafts.
Right. Ixalan Limited would have sucked if there was exactly one Tetsamok in every draft pod and one player got it, right?
Yeah, because that is the perfect comparison.
because it would just be not fun anymore. But the answer is you most of the time you didn't get a Tetsamok. And when you did, there might have been one other player that got three of some other bomb or something. And so that amount of just really amped up variance makes some of the bombier moments a little more tolerable, I think.
Absolutely. The other thing, and really fun.
For sure. The other thing, which I think we remember most are decks that were the highest variance, right? Like, I don't really remember specific drafts where it's like, I really drafted the hard way and I played very diligently and my deck had no rares, but, you know, I still pulled out the 2-1 or the 3-0 or whatever. What I remember is that one time in Guilds of Ravnica where nobody took any red-white cards and I got this incredible aggro deck and I got handed Tajik on, like, you know, third pack, like, halfway through. Like, that's what you remember the most. So I think in terms of creating moments for a game, that's part of what it does. But honestly, I think the biggest factor is that variance, and then also the fact that Retail Limited does get old after you do it for a while. Like, I mean, we listen to Limited Resources avidly, and by the time a format's done, usually they're like, yeah, ready to move on to the next one. And I think they said on a recent episode that if they could have it their way, they would have a new retail set every month or two. Just, you know, constantly keep it moving, because those early days of the format are when it's most interesting, when there's still disagreement on maybe not the biggest power outliers, but disagreement on what is actually the best uncommon in this color or whatever. That's when the format's really interesting, when those things are so shaking out. And then once most players are on the same page, it does get a lot less interesting. And so I think that's one of the reasons why those are the two big reasons why a cube with a very similar power level band to Retail Limited would get old pretty quickly. It's because it's actually much more consistent than Retail Limited, and you will just get tired of it the same way you get tired of a Retail Limited set, but now it's your cube, and so you have nowhere else to go. There's no new cube coming out in 2 months.
I think there's one other big difference, which you kind of hinted at earlier, is that the power level isn't linear. It's not like, okay, you have your Glorybringer up here and your Uthtun Troll down here, and it's a straight line in between, so you kind of end up just cutting off the bottom third of the cards. In most limited sets, things kind of flatten out. You have a couple huge bombs, and then you have a lot of stuff that's in the middle and is pretty flat. And I think
modern limited sets, like, one thing we've noticed over the past, like, 3 years-ish is that there's just, you don't have to play any bad cards in your limited decks anymore.
Exactly.
It used to be that, like, there were a lot of Ds in sets, which were cards you didn't really want to play, but you often would if you just had to get to your 20th, 21st, 22nd card. But now, like, you really don't have to play the dregs. And so it's like, there's a big plateau of all the Cs and, like, Bs and stuff. And then maybe you get a couple spikes, right, where you get a couple really good cards, but... but yeah, things do flatten out pretty quickly.
Yeah, and so I think because the bulk of your sort of draft decisions and gameplay decisions are still mostly in this relatively flat C to B range with a couple outliers, it still means that occasionally you end up feeling like, well, my decisions didn't really matter because my opponent had the one bomb, but a lot of times you do get to feel like those decisions are meaningful.
Something I've thought about for my own cube, and I've seen other cube designers do something like this, which I would maybe be interested in pursuing in the future, but I have not had the motivation to do it, is... I would love to have, like, a core, say, like, 340 cards. Like, this is my cube, 340 card cube, and then have, like, 60 to 80 cards that were a combination of build arounds and extreme power outliers that random 20 got shuffled in every time to try and emulate this idea.
Were you sitting outside of my shower with a brainwave detector?
Do you have the same thought?
You can look at the timestamp on my Cube Cobra list. I started designing this morning.
Well, there you go. I mean, great minds, Anthony. It must be in the water. Because that really is the thing. Like, playing with Tetsamok in Ixalan was great. I loved doing it. I loved playing with Glorybringer. It was really fun to play with God Eternal Oketra. What's not fun is sitting down at a table of 8 people and knowing, well, one of us can have that God Eternal Oketra. And if it's not me, then it's going to be awful to lose to it. And so having the added variance of, like, all right, here are all of these cards that are risky, high power level variants that can potentially totally decide drafts, right? Like, that's the kind of thing, I'd be happy to put Oko in there, right? I'm fine if Oko is in one in every 5 drafts of my cube. What was really getting tiring was Oko being in every draft of my cube, and every time there being a blue-green player, and every time the aggro deck having no hope to beat a turn 2 Oko. Like, that was just, it was just really rough. And so putting some of those cards in those kinds of packs, I think, would be a great way to introduce some of that variance without making it homogenizing. And I think it's very different than, before we get letters, than just saying, well, make your cube 540 or 720 or whatever, because
it's just much harder to build the flat power level list, right, of effectively, you know, the 720 minus the 40 or 50 powerful rares you want to add.
Right, and if there's 80 cards in that pool, I only want 15 or 20 every draft. I don't want those 80 cards all in there or some random combination of them, right? Like, I want a big pool of cards that I only take a small percentage from, and then right. a normal-sized pool of cards I take all of them from, which is very different than mashing these two pools together and saying we take equally from each pool. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it would be a very rewarding design challenge, but a lot of work. And so if you want to do that work, I would love to draft your queue if you do it, because it'd be really fun, I think.
Yeah, I've been thinking for months, you know, my cube is sort of based on a fairly flat power level with a lot of, like, little overlapping mechanics. And I've thought for, you know, since I made it, like, I landed on a couple different overlapping mechanics that I think work really well, but it is definitely not comprehensive of everything that Magic has to offer. There's so many different ways that you could, like, go into enchantments matter and, like, combat tricks matter and all kinds of other interactions. And I've been puttering around every now and then with lists of just sort of, like, if I redesigned my cube with exactly the same philosophy, but just sort of chose different mechanics, could I get at a different and better local maximum? And playing right. a little bit of this Time Spiral Remastered, I really, really love a lot of the interactions between, you know, Madness and Flashback and some of the Blink effects. So I think that this might be the kick that gets me to sort of design the beta version of my cube. It's not that I'm just going to try and totally redesign it. This is just going to be a brand new thing in a parallel universe. And I started out this morning thinking, well, I like this idea of having, like, to inject a couple rares, because right now in my own cube there are some outliers, and they end up getting balanced by the fact that the cube is a little larger, you're not always going to draft them, and most of them have double pips, so you can't just splash them in any deck. If they end up in late picks, you're not going to see them in every deck, or in every draft, but that's still fairly frequent that you end up just losing to a Nesting Dragon. I've gone from this morning thinking, well, what if we have this sort of module of the powerful rares that we just add 20, 24 of before the draft, this core, like, you know, the spike mode cube, absolutely no powerful rares. It's just everything is really, really balanced. And then when you want to, you shuffle in a chunk of this module. And that seemed like, oh, that's cute. I guess it kind of work. It's a little bit of extra work. And over the course of the last 8 hours, I'm like, yes, I am all in. This is how I think I want the next iteration of whatever the next cube project I design to look like.
Well, I'm very glad to be the benefactor of all your hard work and get to play this cube once you've figured it out. So I say do it. I'm very excited about it.
I will definitely need some help.
That's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All of the Magic cards are made by Wizards of the Coast. All of the listening is done by you, and all of the talking is done by me, Andy, and my co-host, Anthony. Thanks for talking about magic with me, Anthony.
Anytime, Andy.
What's his recipe?
Hillary wants to know if you have a recipe to end the show.
So I've been working on a little recipe this week. I'm not an excellent baker. At the beginning of the pandemic, I know everybody got into sourdough, and I struggled with it. But more recently, I realized that pita bread is extremely easy, and it's the starter bread that I should have started with. I've been working on trying to nail down the recipe, and I'm going to find it.
It's fun to make bread in a pan.
Yeah, it's really satisfying. It's very rewarding to watch it puff up. It's a much simpler recipe. It goes pretty quickly. All right, so I start with 220 grams of warm water, add 2 teaspoons of yeast and a bit of sugar, and let that get started. I have no idea if this is actually what you're supposed to do with dry yeast, but that's what my mother always did, so I'm stuck with it.
I like to bake occasionally, but I still, you know, recipes will call for some combination of either active dry yeast, instant yeast, rapid rise yeast, and you know what, Anthony? I never pay attention. I just put whatever yeast in there, and it's never been a problem.
As far as you know.
It comes out good every time.
Then it's not a problem. So you've got your yeast and water. You add 350 grams of flour to your 220 grams of water. And then from there, it's just a matter of kneading, rolling, and proofing. And that's taken a little bit of time to figure out, but mix it, knead it for about 5 minutes. Let it raise for an hour and a half is usually what works for me in my environment. Divide it into 8 balls. Let it rest. Roll them into nice little balls. Let it rest for a bit. Roll them out into pita shapes, and then this is the last step that took me a while to realize is
dough discs.
I think you need to let it rest flattened for another 10-15 minutes before you throw them into a hot 450 degree oven for about 5 minutes, and that last rest after they're shaped means they actually puff up pretty evenly. At least that's been my experience, but I don't know anything about baking. If you are actually a good baker, again, tell me what I'm doing wrong.
I at the beginning of the pandemic, everyone was doing their sourdough thing. And I've had periods in my life where I've baked a fair amount of bread. And eventually I just got so tired of every single recipe being combine flour, water, salt, and yeast until it's doughy. Let it rise till it doubles. Shape it. Let it rise again and bake it until it's bread. And I was just like, I'm not reading recipes anymore. I'm just gonna do stuff. And it was very, very liberating for me just to like hack together some breads based on no recipes at all. Just like, yeah, they all say pretty much some combination of the same thing. They put some extra stuff in. And yeah, I would encourage people to just, freestyle a little bit.
It's really just a question of like, what's your hydration level? What is your rise time and your temperature? And then are you adding oil? Are you adding any other mix-ins that are going to slow down the rise time? But yeah, I mean, if you sort of get those variables, I definitely don't have that intuition yet, but getting to that point where you're not just net decking your bread, you can just pick up and play limited bread is where I want to get to.
I was going to say it was just like cube. Everyone starts their cube with a cube recipe, but then once you get that confidence, baby, you just put whatever cards you want in there, and it's fine.
Magic can teach you about everything bread is
also,
in your life.
Bread is also self-correcting, just like draft, because even bad bread's pretty good. So, you know, you just do it, and it's good. It's like, you know, even drafting an unbalanced cube is still playing Magic, and that's pretty fun. Even a not-so-great bread is still bread.
You know, you
bread,
say that, so. But I think I forgot to say, add a teaspoon of salt in there, too. You will have a bad pita if you don't put any salt in there.